Thanks for downloading this podcast from CelticUnderground.net. This is the seventh season of the Nine Row Chronicles, season 1971-72. It is moving on from with the Lisbon Lions having moved on. We have Dixie Deans, Kenny Dalglish, Lou McCarry, and the final game of Jim Craig. It's another double winning season for the Hoops. We are losing finalists in an incredible League Cup, and we have an almost season in the European Cup where we draw in Milan against Inter Milan but get knocked out on penalties at Celtic Park. In the charts, number one, when the season kicked off, the league season kicked off on the 4th of September, was I'm Still Waiting by Diana Ross, which is playing just now. And if you listen at the end, you'll hear Amazing Grace by the Pipes and Drums and the military band of the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards. Mm-hmm. If you're watching television on the opening day of the season, you would have seen Grandstand, presented by Frank Boff. Then you had Walt Disney, The Wonderful World of Colour, The Boy Who Flew the Condors, then The News, then Journey to the Centre of the Earth, film I can remember seeing myself many a time, Jules Verne film. Then it would have been It's Lulu, with guests including Engelbert Humperdinck and The Hollies. Then you would have seen The Man Called Ironside, News again. Then it would have been Sports Reel, which eventually became Sports Scene. Then Parkinson on at 20 past 11 at night with Shirley MacLaine, one of the guests. Anyway, that was the season 71-72, seventh season in a row. This is Robert, Lackey and St Anthony. And this is me passing over to them. I put him off at last. He could see I had no eyes. So he left me once again. Okay, gents, so we finished last season with the last ever game by the Lisbon Lions and in one team, and we're now in season 71-72, which the league campaign starts off on the 4th of September. So as usual, we will start with the League Cup and the group sections, which again, we've got Rangers in the group sections, and again, we take Rangers out of the League Cup. We have 2-0 victory against Rangers, followed by a 1-0 away win at Morton, a 3-0 away win in Ayr, a 1-0 defeat at home to Morton, a 3-0 victory over Rangers at Ibrox, although I'll get back to the fact that actually, although we beat Rangers 2-0 at home, it was actually the second time we played at Ibrox in the League Cup this season. We beat Ayr United 4-1, Clydebank in the semis, in the quarters, St Mirren in the semis, and then we'll get on to the Partick Thistle game. So, Robert, and I'll start with you, Robert. Were you at any of the League Cup prior to the final?
Yeah, I was at a few of them. I mean, the League Cup campaign started gloriously with two wins over Rangers and ended in calamity in the final. And the curious thing that both games against Rangers were played at Ibrox. The Celtic, the rebuilding of the main stand at Parkhead was not complete and not capable that offer, as they felt it was providing them with an unfair advantage. And I don't understand why. I mean, Hampden would have been the obvious choice for Celtic to play their home match, but for whatever reason, Hampden was not available for the first game in the 14th of August to have both games against Celtic played at Ibrox a fortnight apart. And I think we were quite nicely tuned up for the start of the season. We'd already played in the Driver Cup, played against Dumbarton, St Johnstone and then Aberdeen. So we were ticking over quite nicely. Rangers had played a couple of pre-season friendlies. And the first game, I think, is famous for, or most famous, for the fact that Kenny Dalglish was first of all, he was picked. First time he was picked for an Old Firm game. And then when Celtic got a penalty with about 20 minutes to go, Billy McNeil handed the ball to Kenny. We had just scored to go 1-0 up with a Jimmy Johnson goal. And Kenny was given the responsibility of taking the penalty to more or less put the game out of sight. And when he placed the ball, and he then realised his shoelace was undone, and he knelt down and took his time tying his shoelace. And, you know, it must have been a really nerve-wracking moment for him. But he, you know, he stuck it past McCloy, and that was us off to a great start. We then kind of blew that advantage in the game against Morton at Parkhead, which was about maybe 10 days later. And this was the first game that the new stand was open. And it was a game Celtic were obviously expected to win easily. Morton were so hard up for players that they played a 15-year-old, a guy called Charlie Brown. And Doug Leach missed a penalty in this game, and then Charlie Brown set up a winning goal for Morton, and they won 1-0. And that meant going into the second Old Firm game at Ibrox that Rangers were ahead on goal difference, and probably a draw in that second match would have been enough for them to win the section and eliminate us. But we played extremely well in the second game, and remember a great goal by Tommy Callaghan. But we won 3-0, and very, very convincing, and a bit of a disastrous start to the season for Rangers, quite frankly, which was to carry on into their early league form. So that was us out the group.
Well, did you manage to get to any of those games? Did you get to the opening of the £350,000 main stand? I wonder what that would be. I try. Well, you're talking, Lucky. I'll try and work that out in today's money, £350,000. did you manage to get to any of the games?
I was at most of those games, but do you know, see this whole process that we've been going through, I've just realised that there are games that I was at, and I remember the goals from television. Do you understand what I mean?
Yes.
I was at the game, but when my memory of the goal, when I think of the goals, it's the televisual view that I remember. It's really odd. And going back over previous seasons, I suddenly realised there was games I was at that at the time when we were talking, I wasn't sure. But looking at those games, I was at most of those games, the Rangers games, but my memory of the goals is from the images you get on YouTube or on Celtic TV. It's really weird.
Well, no, I think that's the same for lots of fans, and particularly for, if I think back to lots of really, really important games, you only watch them once in real life. And sometimes, you know, often think about journalists describing a goal for a paper. It can be difficult because sometimes a goal comes out of nothing. You're not expecting it to come. So it's really difficult to then talk about the events that occurred just before the goal. Yeah. So sometimes that can happen. And then the only time that you've really watched the games or the goals with any, paying attention to what happened in previously is when you then subsequently watch it on the telly. And obviously you watched it once in real life. And for momentous games, you probably then watched them 5, 6, 7 times on the television. So it's not completely unusual that you would do that. Do you have any memories of the fact that we played Rangers twice at Ibrox and beat Rangers twice at Ibrox?
Well, I was at the games, but I've seen them on the television. So my strongest memories of the games are watching the goals again and again and again. Because you watch them ad nauseum just because they're beating Rangers. But, you know, there's other games that I was at. I mean, the likes of playing Morton and Ayr United at Celtic Park, I've never been at those games. I have no recollection of them other than what I read in books.
So just to fill you in while you've been talking about that, the £350,000 main stand shows you in construction inflation as well. The £350,000 main stand would be £4.35 million in today's money. So that was that. So
I'm surprised it's so low.
Well, yeah, a modern stand would be roughly. Because that stand takes about 7,500, so a bog standard sort of St Mirren, you know, bar constructed box type stand that took 7,500 would be about £8 million today. Building a proper main stand that was half decent, that would be the type of main stand that we would build, would be about £20 million, £30 million.
To be fair though, if Celtic had built a proper main stand the way that the Rangers did in terms of the new stands at Ibrox, I'm not, you know, Celtic tried to build round the skeleton of what was there, as usual they did it in the cheap. You know, that board wouldn't spend money they didn't need to spend. So that doesn't actually reflect the price of what a proper stand would have cost you in those days.
So, you took us so far, Robert. Do you want to take us the rest of the way through the League Cup and into the final, which I know I keep saying this when I do these podcasts. If social media existed today, then with what then came in that final, what an incredible barra. I mean, the volume of calls for Steen to be sacked would have been definite.
Harry, can I come in there a wee bit in the Rangers game just to make a wee comment?
Yep.
It was Rangers actually beat, before the season started, they beat both Everton and Spurs at Ibrox in what we used to call in these challenge matches. They were a wee bit more competitive than the friendly games you get now, and there was a great sort of morale booster for them going into the season. And I'm sure that John Gregg was quoted in the paper as saying that this Rangers team is better prepared than any other Rangers team that he'd ever been with. So for them to go into the two Celtic games and have home advantage and lose the two of them, their season, by and large, was just about done by the end of August. And the interesting thing about Dalglish was Dalglish had scored a lot of goals in the Drybrough Cup games. He'd exploded onto the scene. He was scoring threes and fours, but he wasn't a certain starter for the first big game in the season, which would have been Rangers at Ibrox, because at that time Celtic had such a great choice. You know, you had Lennox, you had Hood, you had McCarry, you had John Hughes, Willie Wallace, and it wasn't a risk for Jock Steen putting him in, but it was something of a surprise, in as much as this was the first big opportunity in a big game. He had games where he had played, but this was the first time that he's right in there in a really high pressurised game. And as Robert says there, the penalty kick thing is very amusing. And in later years, with his dry sense of humour, people used to say to Dalglish, "What were you doing when you tied your laces? Were you trying to gather your thoughts?" And he says, "No, my lace was loosened."
You mentioned there saying about Rangers saying, "Well, this is an amazing season for Rangers because they can't get out of the group stages of the League Cup. They lose 11 league games, and they win the Cup Winners' Cup. I mean, domestically they're shit, and yet they go on to win the Cup Winners' Cup, which we'll talk about." Because
so I think the other thing about Kenny Dalglish is we finished the last podcast talking about him scoring six in the Frank Beattie testimonial match in May 71, and that he'd been moved into a striker role for the reserves and had scored a bundle of goals against Rangers. So he started this season with four against Dumbarton in the Drybrough Cup, then a hat-trick against St Johnstone in the Drybrough Cup semi-final, which was played at Firhill, and then he's straight into the big game at Ibrox. And, you know, he was just in phenomenal scoring form, which he absolutely maintained at least through until Christmas in this breakthrough season for him. But, the rest of the League Cup campaign, you know, two big wins over Clydebank. I think one thing that was noteworthy about the Clydebank game at Parkhead was the debut of Brian McLaughlin, who was only 16 years old. And interestingly, Steen was asked many, many years later, who was the best player you ever signed? And he said Brian McLaughlin. And I guess we'll talk about McLaughlin a bit more in the next couple of podcasts, and what a player, what a career he could have had with us had it not been for injury. I don't remember anything about the semi at all against St Mirren. I'm sure I was there. And then we get, you know, Partick Thistle in the final. They were just newly promoted. They had been brought up by David McParland. It was a pretty young team. They had beaten Rangers in the first league game of the season in a match which finished 3-2 at Firhill, where their winger Johnny Gibson ran riot. And it was a game that Thistle should have won by more. They had beaten St Johnstone, and this is a very good St Johnstone team that won at Parkhead and knocked Hamburg out of the Intercities First Cup. Thistle beat them 5-1 in the League Cup quarter-final. So they had some capabilities. You know, Thistle, you know, on their day, they were capable. Young team, lot of legs. And we didn't know it at the time, but five or six of the Thistle team that played against us in that League Cup final would go on to play for Scotland.
Yeah.
In fact, four of them would go on to play for Celtic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, indeed, David McParland would end up at Parkhead as well as Jock's assistant. But there's no doubt it was just another one of these occasions where I think we were overconfident. There was nothing really in our form leading up to the game that suggested that we were going to have a bad day. We'd lost a match in Copenhagen. We had lost to St Johnstone in the league. But we'd generally been winning and winning well. So there's a couple of things happened on the day. So the BBC Football Focus programme on the morning of the match, which many of us will remember, Football Focus, especially the Bob Wilson years, but this was pre-Bob Wilson, so it was Sam Leach, who, in his comments about the match, said on BBC television, Thistle have got no chance. Then talking to Bob McDowell, who's one of my oldest friends, an absolutely rabid Thistle supporter, and he knows all the players who played in 71, and he said they were wound up by Lou McCarry at the start of the game, and Lou McCarry spoke to several of the Thistle players and said, you're looking forward to picking up your runners-up medals today. And we talked in the last couple of podcasts about some of these games at Hampden in the previous 2 years. Air United, 3-3. Dumbarton, 4-3. Aberdeen Cup final, we got beaten. Airdrie, 3-3. So we had this nasty habit that we were developing of conceding three goals at Hampden in big games that we were expected to win. And, you know, Thistle had gone one better than that before the half-time whistle had even sounded. So maybe there was attitude problems. Team-wise, Big Billy was injured. He had missed a couple of games and he wasn't fit enough to return. So we went with a George Connolly, Jim Brogan centre-back partnership. Both George and Jim were excellent players alongside Big Billy, but maybe not without Billy being there. And Thistle were two up pretty quickly in this game. Good shots from outside the box. And then our next misfortune was that Jimmy Johnson was the subject of a very bad tackle by Ronnie Glavin, which put Jinky out of the match after 20 minutes. Jim Craig came on. And the first half may have been, you know, the most catastrophic 45 minutes in Celtic's history, because we were four down. There's loads of footage on YouTube with Arthur Montford and fairly liberal use of the word sensation every time Thistle scored. But it was sensational. And what I heard about I mean, the three of the four goals were from set pieces, which, you know, maybe if Big Billy had been there, we would have been much better prepared. But what I heard was that the Thistle dressing room at half-time was dead quiet. They were all sitting in silence. They couldn't believe what they had achieved in the first half. And I think they were still pretty worried about what might happen in the second half. There was a great line about Grandstand, BBC Grandstand, the Saturday afternoon programme, which was presented by Frank Boff, obviously somewhere in a studio in England, either in Manchester or in London. And he, at halftime, he says, we have a halftime score coming through from the Scottish League Cup final at Hampden, which is Partick Thistle 4, Celtic 0. Obviously, we'll have that score line double-checked for you. That was his announcement to the nation. The second half, I remember when Kenny Dalglish scored, and there was still about 20 minutes left. I thought we still had a chance. I thought, well, if we get a second one in the next 5 minutes, we can do this. And the Celtic fans got a lot of praise that day for staying till the end and applauding Partick Thistle off the field. And this was acknowledged by the Thistle chairman a few weeks later when we played them at Firhill. And, I mean, indisputably, they were the best team on the day. They could have scored much more than four. They missed a few good chances. Williams had a couple of saves. And I suppose if you're going to lose 4-1 in any cup final, losing to Partick Thistle's probably one of the better options, because they're a club that doesn't offend anybody. So,
yeah, I'd rather lose to Thistle 4-1 in a cup final than a team from the south side of Glasgow.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, or Hearts, or, you know, many other teams that mention. So it was, you know, it was the greatest, it was the most glorious day in their history. And, you know, it's their 50th anniversary of winning the League Cup next October. And I think, you know, I think it will be a big bash for them. They won the Scottish Cup in 1921, so I've been told for years that Thistle are going to win a big cup in 2021 at the 50-year intervals, but I wouldn't put money on it right now.
I think the interesting thing that day was Jockstein's choice of substitute. In those days, you were only allowed one substitute, and Steen, through a habit, always tended to pick a forward player, because I think he realised if you were going to change the team, and you were in trouble, then bringing a forward on would generally be a good idea. And for some reason that day, he fielded Jim Craig as a substitute. So when Jimmy Johnson gets injured and goes off, and Jim Craig goes on, the Celtic team becomes very lopsided, and it cuts down our options in attack. And for what I can gather for people who were there, I remember my dad talking about it, that Jim Craig coming on, you know, didn't have the same impact as if Harry Hood would have been there, or Bobby Lennox would have come on, that would have given Celtic greater impetus. But I actually remember that day quite vividly. I wasn't at the game, but I remember my dad coming home and he was laughing. And I thought this was strange, because he was normally in a bad mood when Celtic get beat. And he said it was just one of the days. He said you could play Thistle 100 times, and that 99 times, that would never happen. But on that day, Thistle played well, we played very poorly, and all the circumstances, like McNeil getting injured before the game, and Jinky getting injured during the game, everything went Thistle's way.
Well, a month later, Celtic beat them 5-1.
Absolutely. And in fact, the Saturday after the League Cup final, Thistle went to Pittodrie and lost 7-2.
Mm-hmm.
And a few weeks after that, they beat Motherwell 8-3 at home. So they were a bit up and down. I mean, on their day, they were brilliant, because they had good wingers. They had, you know, Jimmy Bone was a good goal scorer.
Frank Coulston was a terrific player.
Indeed.
Very, very, very quick. And he was an intelligent guy. He became
the only one of the forwards not to score.
I know, but his move, if you watch, his movement was terrific around. You know, the fact that McNeil wasn't there, I think Frank Coulson took advantage of the fact that the other two guys weren't actually centre-halves.
No.
And he terrorised them with his movement. I think maybe that's why Steen brought on Craig, because the defence was getting torn to shreds. I felt very sorry for Evan Williams. I watched the game again last night, and he was made the scapegoat, and yet it was chaos all around him. It really was. I mean, they ripped him apart time and again. In the second half, I agree with Robert. Celtic played much better in the second half. And had they scored earlier, they might have put up a challenge. But the first half was just mayhem.
I mean,
and I think there was consequences. You know, I think you mentioned Evan Williams. He was immediately dropped after that final, although I'm not sure that I would be blaming him for too many of the goals. But we signed Dennis Conaghan from St Mirren, who went in.
I read that they signed Conaghan because he'd played so well in the semi-final against Celtic, and Celtic won the semi-final. But Dennis, much as I quite like all Celtic players, he wasn't above making mistakes as well.
No. Well, Dennis Conaghan had been a Celtic
youth player
mm-hmm. and had left and gone to St Mirren. The other consequence, I think, was that maybe it was the end of the road, that cup final for Tommy Gemmell. He only played a couple of games after that. And the other consequence was maybe that Steen bought Dixie Deans a couple of weeks later to get another forward. So.
And Yogi and Wallace were away the week before, weren't they?
They'd gone the week before, but I think Steen still thought we'd plenty firepower between, you know, Hood, Lennox, McCarrie, Dalglish, Chip in, Jimmy Johnson, Vic Davidson. But then he bought Dixie, and what a great signing that was.
I mean, you mentioned the team, Robert. The Thistle team was Rough, Hansen, Forsyth, Glavin, Campbell, Strachan, McQuaid, Coulson, Bone, Ray, Laurie. Celtic team was Williams, Hay, Gemmell, Murdoch, Connolly, Brogan, Johnson, who Craig came on for, Dalglish, Hood, Callaghan, McCarrie. So, I mean, we've all been at games. I remember getting in a debate once with someone on Twitter who couldn't understand the difference between a good performance and a good result, because I'd said Celtic had lost a game or something like that, and I'd said, yeah, but despite the result, it was actually a good performance. How can you say it's a good performance? Because we've all been at games where a team takes four shots and scores four goals, and you think, if that game's played another 100 times, they would not score four goals. It was just one of those days, but just remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, like the game in Bratislava, Strachan's first game.
Yeah.
You know, when we lost 5-0 was exactly that kind of game where I think they had five shots and they all went in.
So
that's interesting. You know, we had signed Gordon Marshall in the summer, and he made a couple of appearances. And I think the fact that we went out and signed Dennis Conaghan meant that Steen hadn't liked what he'd seen of Gordon Marshall.
And in fact, when we signed,
he played a couple of games.
Dennis Conaghan's the first goalkeeper I can remember playing for Celtic. And when we signed Dennis Conaghan, that then meant we had Fallon, Williams, Conaghan, Marshall, Lally. Those were the five goalkeepers that we had.
At the one time, which,
again, it's a bit like during the more recent years when we keep signing these forwards in the summer. It just demonstrates that the manager's just not quite sure what to do about the goalkeeping position and doesn't know who to sign. But you're right, Hughes and Wallace left just before that. Conaghan signed virtually the next day. Dixie Dean signed a couple of weeks later. And Tommy Gemmell left 2 months later. So it's quite a line in the sand, obviously, for Jock Steen. He wouldn't have wanted to be humiliated to lose 4-1 in a cup final. But interestingly, in the league that season, We only lost two games all season, and one of those was after we tied up the title. You know, after, you know, if, to jump on to the league campaign again, and we seem to start the league campaign a lot playing Clyde during this 9-0 period. We opened the league campaign on the 4th of September with a 9-1 victory over Clyde. We beat Rangers 3-2, which we'll get back to. Again, we always seem to play Rangers in the second or third game inside the first three games. We beat Rangers 3-2, meaning we've beaten Rangers three times at Ibrox inside the first
4 weeks.
4 weeks of the season. And then we beat Morton, beat Airdrie. Again, getting back to your comment, Robert, about the quality of St Johnstone. We lose to St Johnstone 1-0. And then right the way through, we only draw for the rest of the 1971 period of the 71-72 campaign. We draw with Aberdeen, and that's it. So, what's your... And of course, the big thing here is there is no New Year's Gate fixture. We don't play Rangers on the 1st of January this year. We do play them on the 3rd of January, but on the 1st of January we're actually... playing Clyde, because obviously this is a year on from the Ibrox disaster. So, memories of the league campaign?
Yeah, I was at the vast majority of the league games that season. Certainly the 9-1 against Clyde, remember. Last podcast we talked about finishing the season, beating Clyde 6-1. Lennox got a hat-trick. So we started this league campaign, beating Clyde 9-1. Lennox got a hat-trick. And we beat Clyde 7-0 on New Year's Day. So, not surprisingly, they got relegated this season. Of the three wins at Ibrox over that 28-day period, the league win 3-2 was the most controversial game and the one that's most vivid in my memory. And... we had led in that game, but then Rangers scored two goals very quickly before half-time. They got a controversial penalty, which Willie Johnson scored. And so we were 2-1 down at half-time. We got a goal disallowed, I think Jinky. And then Alfie Conn got sent off. I can't remember what for. I think the equivalent of two yellows. We got back to two each, and then the real controversial moment in the match was a disallowed Rangers goal where Colin Steen got clear of the defence and he ran at Evan Williams, who came out of his goals. Steen got there first with a reasonably high boot and flicked it over Evan Williams into the net. We would have put Rangers 3-2 up, even though they were down to 10 men. And the referee... can't recall who the ref was. The goal was disallowed for a high foot by Steen, which was
dubious.
A marginal decision. And I think if it happened to us, if the boot had been on the other foot, we would have been absolutely raging at the goal being disallowed. And then, memorably, we scored in the very last minute when Jimmy Johnson got up for a header. He got up above Matheson, I think it was, and he looped a header into the net. I mean, how Jimmy Johnson could win a header against anybody was... but he did... I think he did score three seasons in a row, or three seasons out of four. He scored at Ibrox in league games with headers. So, pretty unusual. But this one, he really climbed off the ground, you know, as if it was... Dixie Deans or something like that, and a brilliant header, and that won the game. And
he scored a header at Tynecastle, which was a magnificent header. He was good in the air. When he had to do it, he could score.
Did they beat Rangers 3-2? I remember vividly that day being out with my mother. We were out shopping, and Robert and George, we both remember, there used to be a big supermarket called Galbraith's. Mm-hmm. They were all over Glasgow. They were very, very common. And I remember coming back out of the shops and living fairly near to Ibrox. We were lucky because we stayed at the end of government where the Celtic buses used to park. And I remember this drunk Celtic fan coming back, and I'm thinking, I wonder what the score was here. And my mother wasn't very pleased, but I said to the guy, hey, mate, what was the score? And he says, 3-2, Jimmy Johnson scored in the last minute with a header. And I remember thinking, oh, yes, my dad's going to come back in a right good mood tonight. This is going to be a good night. So it's, but I just remember the wee drunk guy with a Celtic scarf. And even without asking him, I knew Celtic had won, but I just remember him saying, Jimmy Johnson scored with a header, and that was great.
Lachie, did you make me memories of that game?
Aye, I was at that game. But again, that's one of the games I'm telling you about that I can... My memory of the goals is televisual, but I remember being at the game, and I remember Jinky scoring. It's a strange thing, this, when trying to remember things and you realise you've seen them in from different perspectives. And the strongest perspective is the one that you saw on the telly. I find that very odd.
So in that during that run to the New Year period, Bob Kelly passes away. So that must have been... Lucky, quite an event at Celtic at the time, because he'd been such an influential figure over the club. So he died in September. Was there much fuss made about it? Do you remember?
I don't think it. I mean, look at the recent deaths. You see Tommy Burns and Jinky and Billy McNeil. There was nothing like that. There was no great outpouring of grief, because, as you said last week, it was a different world. You mentioned that Lady Diana kind of broke the bank as far as grief went, public grief. But, I mean, Pope kind of recognised his contribution, apparent contribution to the Celtic over the years. And there's still this thing about the Kelly kids and all that, and all that kind of stuff was trotted out. But we discussed last week about the fact that he got the knighthood. Why he got the knighthood, why his team didn't. So he was a significant figure in Scottish football. There's no question about that. But when you look back, and hindsight's always a 20/20 vision, whether he was always good for Celtic in footballing terms is correct. I think there's no doubt he was a good influence as a man. He knows that his heart was in the right place. He loved the Celtic. But there are a lot of things that happened over the years that made you wonder, was it a totally benign thing for Celtic as a football club that he had so much power? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think the appointment of Steen, you know, secured a legacy for Bob Kelly, which would not have been the case had he not appointed Steen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kelly had exercised too much power for far too long over matters. And, you know, conceivably we could have made a move for Jock Steen 4 years earlier after he had won the Scottish Cup with Dunfermline. And, you know, things would have turned out differently earlier for us. But, yes, like he says, his heart was in the right place. He didn't take any prisoners. He stood up for what he thought was right. And
there's a video on Celtic TV at the moment. There's a memory of John Clark's career, and you see John Clark with John Corain and a Ford Anglia, and they're talking about the fact that Sir Robert Kelly brought Steen in and told him he could go no further at Celtic because he wasn't a Catholic. And John Corain said it broke Steen's heart. He was in tears. Because, he had been close to Kelly when he was captain. You read these stories about him going around to supporters' clubs, you know, with Kelly, with the Scottish Cup, the Coronation Cup, things like that. And he was doing a great job as the youth coach. But to be told that was why he wouldn't get the job really hurt Steen. And John Corain said that he was literally in tears. So he made a decision there that it's not a nice decision. It doesn't serve Steen well for his service. And when he goes back, it's because I think prior to that season, Neely Mokin offered the opinion that Celtic were finished. And his desperation, it drives him back to Steen.
Now, Kelly had been very ill. It wasn't a shock when he died. He hadn't been at a game for some time, and I think he was housebound towards the end. But the one death that there was an outpouring of grief was Charlie Tully's, I think, at the beginning of the season. And I remember reading somewhere that the troubles were about to hit their peak in 1971. And for 48 hours in the period of Charlie Tully being buried, there was a cessation of violence within Belfast out of respect for Charlie Tully and both sides of the divide. And then after the funeral, they went back to normal. But the point is, Charlie was so respected, and he was only a young man. I think off the top of my head, he was 47. So that death, I think, affected the Celtic fans a wee bit more profoundly than what Robert Kelly did.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Kelly's did, but from my perspective as a Celtic fan who was coming in the scene as a boy, that then I can trace the decline of Celtic to Kelly's death, because when Desmond White comes in, and things begin to deteriorate pretty badly, because up until now, but we've held on to our best players. The guys that we are selling are the guys that Jock Steen thinks that he's had the best years. But as we're about to find out in the next few weeks, the real good players who we should have been building a team around began to leave, and that, I don't think that would have happened if Kelly had stayed.
Possibly not.
Although Kelly had some history of, you know, selling Crerand and Bertie Auld and. Yeah. You know, Bobby Collins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I agree. I agree with you, Saint, that, you know, the decline set in. I think Desmond White was a fairly dour character. I'm sure we'll talk about him going forward. But, famously, just going back to Charlie Tully, the Celtic team were in Ireland at the time of his death. I think we were playing a pre-season friendly in Limerick. Mm-hmm. Which was another game. Dalglish scored 4 or 5 goals. And when they heard about Charlie Tully dying, I think Steen and McNeil and one or two others made their way to participate, and they were pallbearers in the funeral.
Sean Fallon would be there, and Neely Mokin. I think they were all there. Do you know, that's one thing I saw. The very end of Bobby Evans, just before he left, and I saw Willie Fernie and Bertie Peacock, but I don't remember seeing Charlie Tully. And that's, there's not enough good footage to get a real idea of what he was like. And yet when you read about him, he was a wonderful footballer and a true genius. But I have no concept of, do you know what I mean? Of him as a player, other than what I read in the papers and reading the books.
And the other thing around about this time is Rangers were playing Rennes in the Cup Winners' Cup, and the Rennes manager came to Ibrox to see them play Celtic. Now, I think it was the game where we won 3-0. After the game, he was asked about the Rangers players, and all he could talk about was Celtic. And he says, I think off the top of my head, that they were either the second or the third team in Europe, in his opinion, behind the great Ajax team at the time. And what the reason for Celtic's good form early in the season was the fact that we get Bobby Murdoch back to full fitness.
Yeah.
The season before that, Bobby had trouble with a shoulder injury, and I think he had a wee bit of trouble with his weight, and Celtic had tried to get sent him away somewhere to a health farm or whatever it was. But it's noticeable that when Bobby Murdoch's on song in the beginning of the season, Celtic are playing. And I really feel sorry for Bobby, because he was a captain against Partick Thistle. Mm-hmm. And for a great Celtic servant like that, it would have been good to see him lift a trophy to sort of crown his service to Celtic. And sadly, Bobby's remembered as a captain in that fateful day.
Well, talking of signings and the impact that players can make, we've talked about Dalglish coming into the team. He was scoring, he'd scored in the friendly at the end of last season, and then he scored in the Dryburgh Cup. And then in end of November, we signed beginning of November, we signed Dixie Dean from Motherwell, and he made his debut in a 5-1 victory away to Thistle. And the amazing thing about that season is the goals tally, and you can see the difference that those two players make, or the young players are making. Lou McCarrie scores 24 goals in 38 games. And Dalglish scores 23 goals in 49 games. And Dixie Dean scores 27 goals in 27 games in the 71-72 season. So it really shows you, I mean, it does help when you bang in a barrel load in a cup final, but it really shows you the difference that the Dixie Deans and those and Dalglish and McCarrie made to the Celtic team in banging in the goals. You know, we get through to January, and I'll take it through to the New Year games again. One of the last times, I'm not sure if it's the last time, we play on Christmas Day in 1971. Mm. December, because I remember Lou McCarrie being on the radio once and somebody talked about playing football on Christmas Day, and Lou McCarrie saying something like, not in his day, it was years before his time. Lou McCarrie played in the last time Celtic played on Christmas Day. Celtic beat Hearts 3-2 on Christmas Day. Then they beat Clyde 7-0 at Shawfield on January 1st, and then played Rangers at Celtic Park on the 3rd of January and beat them 2-1. So at that point, we were quite comfortably looking on course as title contenders, because Rangers had not had a great campaign. As I say, they ended up losing 11 games that season in the league. So any other specific memories of the league campaign through to New Year?
Yeah, I think Aberdeen had a very good first half of the season. They had lost Eddie Turnbull as manager, who had gone to Hibs, and they promoted his assistant or the trainer, Jimmy Bonthrone. Eddie Turnbull at the start of the season, Aberdeen had got off to a good start, continued their form from the previous season when they challenged us all the way. And when they came to Parkhead in November, there was only one point in it between Celtic and Aberdeen. Rangers had already fallen away. I think 64,000 turned up at the match, and we played well. We were winning. And then an own goal by McNeil near the end. He headed across past Dennis Conaghan. Aberdeen happy to go away with a 1-1. But I remember Dixie's debut at Firhill. So when we had signed him earlier in November, he was suspended at the time. He was on a 6-week suspension with Motherwell. And he had a bit of a history at Motherwell of being a bad boy. And we went to Firhill, obviously looking for revenge at the end of November. Big crowd, 36,000, something like that, which Firhill held at that time. I could walk there from my home. And we absolutely bat up Thistle 5-1, and that was very sweet. And between then and the Rangers game in early January, I think Dixie scored pretty much every game. He was red hot right from the beginning. McCarrie was also in great form that season, as you said, Harry, with 24 goals. And I think there was another game where Dalglish got a hat-trick against Dundee, a great hat-trick, and that's another one that sticks in the memory. So we had a great run through to the New Year holiday period, and Aberdeen were still going pretty strong as well. And even Rangers had put together a winning run leading up to the Old Firm game, which was on 3rd of January or something. And that Old Firm game, I wasn't at it, but I remember listening to it on the radio. And the only thing I remember is the goal in the last minute by Jim Brogan, the most unlikely of heroes. And when I saw it later on telly, I think it was like a big hoof from Harry Hood up the park, and Brogan ran and ran and ran, and this ball dropped out of the sky. He got on the end of it and headed it in the corner. And fantastic moment for him.
Yeah, no, but Harry Hood never hoofed the ball.
In life. Yeah. There's an interesting story I'd like to share with you about that Rangers game. In later life, there was somebody that I got to know who actually worked in the main stand at the time, because when the stand was built, it had faults, and it meant that they had to workmen in during the week to put things right before the games. And Jock Stein used to come out every day and have a wee bit of banter with the workers. And the Rangers game was coming up, and Desmond White came out, and his appreciation to the guys, I think there was 10 of them in total, he gave them 10 terracing tickets as freebies for going to the Rangers game, which was a great gesture, thoroughly appreciated. But this guy that I know said to Desmond White, he says, "I'm sorry, Mr. White," he says, "but four of the guys here are Rangers fans. Could you see your way to giving them Rangers end tickets?" And Desmond White replied to him, "If they want Rangers end tickets, they can go to Ibrox and see Willie Waddle." Right? And very curtly, and walked away. So Jock Stein came out, and he asked how the guys were, where are they going to the game? And this guy replied, "Well, some of us are Jock and some of us aren't," and told them the story about the Rangers tickets, Rangers end tickets. So they had a wee bit of banter about the game. And Jock Stein says to these guys, "Who do you think's the first name in my team sheet when we play Rangers?" And they all went, "Jimmy Johnson." They went, "No." And the next one says, "Billy McNeil, because he's a captain." And they went, "No." And somebody else says, "Oh, Kenny Dalglish." And they went, "No." So they were going to be, but they thought Jock Stein was pulling their leg. And Jock Stein turned and says, "The first name in the team sheet when we play Rangers is Jim Brogan." He says, "Because when you play Rangers, you know it's going to be a physical game, and you need to fight fire with fire, so that they know that they can't intimidate the Jimmy Johnsons and the Harry Hoods and the Tommy Callaghans, the football players that Celtic have got in the team." He says, "You need guys like Jim Brogan in there to protect them." He says, "That's why I would always pick him first against Rangers." And later that afternoon, Jock Stein came back, and he had four Rangers end tickets that he'd procured, and he gave them to the four Rangers fans to make sure that they would get into the game as well.
Were you at the game, Wacky?
Yeah, I was at that game.
And do you have any memories of it?
Just as Robert was saying, it was a close win, a late winner. It's always nice to get a late winner, an unlikely scorer. I don't remember it being a brilliant goal, but they all count. And that was more or less a clean sweep against Rangers for the whole season.
Four wins out of four.
It was the first time Celtic had beaten Rangers twice in the league since 1912.
Away, is that right?
Aye.
The
Celtic team that day was Conaghan, Hay, Brogan, Dalglish, McNeil, Connolly, Johnson, Lennox, Deans, Callaghan, Hood. Substitute was Danny McGrain. Rangers team, again, getting back to its names I recognise from being the, you know, from being aware of Rangers in the late 70s. McCloy, Jardine, Matheson, Gregg, Jackson, Smith, McLean, Johnson, Steen, McDonald, Johnson. Alfie Conn was on the substitute bench.
Do you know what's worth noting out of that? You made a point there earlier about these guys that are scoring the goals. Dixie's getting the goals. Lou McCarry's getting the goals. Kenny's getting the goals. Kenny actually, in the early days, played a lot of games at right half. So it says a lot for him that he gets so many goals. But he doesn't always play as a striker. Through that first season, I'd say maybe half the games that he played either in an inside right position or a right half position, rather than the out-and-out striker that he became in years to come.
I'm sure his first start against Raith Rovers, he played right half.
He did.
Because I was in the jungle that day, I remember that.
But I think there was two things happened this season, 71-72. One, Murdoch got injured just after that debacle against Thistle, so he hurt his shoulder and he was out for a while. And Dalglish dropped deeper.
Yes.
And then I think after signing Deans and McCarry both on fire that season, that I think Kenny, who had started the season more in a striker role before Deans was signed, Kenny dropped a bit deeper. If you look at the stats, mm-hmm. I think Kenny Dalglish only scored maybe five goals after Christmas, whereas he probably had nearly 20 before then, or more than that if you include the Dryburgh Cup games. But I think the league campaign, I mean, Aberdeen's challenge basically ended at the end of February when they sold their captain, Martin Buchan, to Manchester United. And they were still pretty close to us. They were within about 3 points of us at that stage. And it was a big fee. It was £130,000, which was huge money. It was, in fact, it was a record price that Man United had ever paid for anybody. Mm-hmm. And after that game, they lost the first game. They lost at Firhill after selling Buchan, and therefore, you know, their title challenge just fell away quite quickly, and it, you know, ended up being very comfortable for us and winning it by
10 points
with, you know, and the last two games were dead rubbers, which we only picked up 1 point from those two games. So,
Martin Buchan is an interesting individual. As well as being a brilliant player, he was really quite a clever guy. And I remember reading when he went to Manchester United, they were going abroad to play a game and they refused to surrender his passport. He said he was quite capable of handing his own passport over. He was a guy who read books and things like that, which didn't always go down well in professional.
He also created a bit of controversy in the mid-70s by claiming that he could never sign for Rangers due to their anti-Catholic signing policy.
I didn't know that.
He became captain of Manchester United.
He was a great player.
Quite quickly, as soon as Bobby Charlton retired,
yeah.
Buchan became the captain at Old Trafford. He was no more than 23 at that time.
The other interesting thing, we talked about, you know, at the beginning of this 9-in-a-row, how well the Scottish teams were doing in Europe. And in last week's podcast, I then started to talk about the Scottish teams not doing so well in Europe, but the national side started to do well. Tommy Docherty took over the Scotland national side at this time, and the Scottish national side. But Martin Buchan is that point, again, getting back to the players leaving. Martin Buchan is the start of that real trend of the talented Scottish players, before they've reached their peak in Scotland, starting to head down south. Buchan goes this New Year's game. Malcolm Allison, who was Man City manager at the time, he was up watching Willie Johnson at Rangers. And obviously we know what happens with Hay and Macari, and Dalglish stays a wee bit longer. But you're just, Martin Buchan really is the start of the point of the English top flight starting to spend a bit of money in Scotland to take our best players, which had been in a bit of abeyance in the late 60s.
Certainly, Thistle lost a couple of their cup-winning team
quite quickly.
Yeah. Jimmy Bone went down to England, I think, to play for Norwich. Alex Forsyth went to Manchester United.
Yeah. Alan Hansen went to Liverpool.
Yeah. No,
it was John Hansen that was in the team. Alan Hansen came later, but even John Hansen played for Scotland. Tommy Docherty gave him a cap, I think.
I think what's noticeable is these guys get capped while they're at Scottish clubs, and they begin to rub shoulders with the likes of Billy Bremner and Peter Lorimer and Dennis Law and Archie Gemmell, who are big, big players in England at the time. And there's no doubt that when they were sitting in a hotel at night, they'd be saying, "How much are you on a week?" And the Scottish guys would be thinking, "Oh my God, you know, this is head-turning stuff here. If I could just get a transfer down to England." And for what I can gather as well, there was a wee bit of tapment on as well. There's no doubt that when some of the Scots players joined up with the Anglos, that Don Revie would probably say to Billy Bremner, do you want to suss out, I don't know, off the top of my head, like Arthur Graham, to see if he would be happy coming to Leeds. So there was a lot of that going on behind the scenes.
A much later day, I heard an interview the other day with Paddy Bonner, and he was talking about players that he played with and who was the best, and he said that the best goalkeeper was Shea Givens. He talked about the time. Remember that photograph in the Celtic View of Shea Givens and Brad Friedel and, you know, umpteen great goalkeepers, none of whom ended up playing for the Celtic. But he said that they'd offered Shea Givens, when he came out of the youth, they offered him a professional contract. And he was actually going to be on less money because they weren't going to pay his lodgings, which they did as a youth player. He was going to need to pay his own lodgings. So this professional contract, he was going to be on less money as he'd been as a youth player.
Mm-hmm.
And who was it he signed for, Shea Givens?
Blackburn.
They offered him £500 a week rather than £50 a week, which was in the contract from Celtic. So that's why Shea Givens went down south. And even at that stage, the disparity in wages and how Celtic perceived the value of their players was astonishing. Blackburn would pay £500 a week to a youth goalkeeper, and Celtic were insulting them, really.
From what I can gather, the difference for Celtic players was the fact that the terrific bonuses. Now, but in a couple of weeks, we'll talk about the reason that Davy Hay left. So I don't really want to get into that in detail. But I just want to make the point here that Celtic players had a low, not a low basic wage, but a reasonable basic wage, which would have been lower than the Anglos. But if you had a good season where you won the league, the Scottish Cup, and you go to the quarterfinals, semi-finals of Europe, it put you on a par with what the English players were earning. But as we're going to find out in the weeks ahead, the problem would come is if you get injured and you're only getting the bonuses, then you became unsettled.
Bertie Old tells a story about being in the tunnel with John Gregg and asking him, what's your bonus today? And I think John Gregg asked Bertie Old, and Bertie Old said £10. And Gregg said, oh, we're on 15. And Bertie says, ours is guaranteed.
So normally at this point I move to the
school. Before we go in,
yep.
After the game against Airdrie in January, Evan Williams come back into the team and played to the end of the season.
Well, that's what I was
Cronahan,
just
Cronahan got injured.
He injured.
Well, anyway, Evan Williams come back in.
That's what I was going to say. Normally I go into the Scottish Cup, but I'll continue with the league because we tie up the league so early this season. And yes, despite Jock Stein's issues with goalkeepers, Evan Williams does come back in because Conaghan's injured. However, we do see Gordon Marshall Sr. leaves for Aberdeen and John Fallon leaves for Motherwell in the second half of the league campaign. And it's a campaign where Celtic pretty much just march on to the title. We drop points after we beat Rangers. We drop points with a draw at Capello against Morton, but then we win against Airdrie, St Johnson, Hibs, Dunfermline, A United. We draw with Aberdeen, getting back to your point, Robert, about this is a good Aberdeen team. We then beat Falkirk, Thistle, Kilmarnock, East Fife, Motherwell, Dundee United, and it's in that East Fife game on the 15th of April before the end of our European campaign, which we'll get onto, and before the Scottish Cup final, which we'll get onto, that we tie up the title. So, Lackey, do you have any clear memories of any of the games running up or including the East Fife game in the league to clinch the title?
Not clear memories, no. I mean, they were just ticking off league games on their way to winning the league. It was quite clear, as Robert said, Aberdeen's challenge had declined, and it was just a case of ticking the games off till the thing was over. And can I tell you something about that? See that game that the game they lost to Hearts? I think it was the second last league game of the season.
Yep.
They lost to Hearts 4-1. I was reading that Jock Stein had gone away that day down to England to watch England play West Germany in the European Championship. So he wasn't there that day. But I remember
A lot of people weren't there that day because the Celtic fans boycotted the game.
That's right. Yeah, I went down. We were, St Mungo's FPs were playing St Joseph's College at Dumfries. And I went down to that game. And we watched the Germany game, West Germany and England game on the telly, after we had our meal at St Joseph's. And I remember watching Günter Netzer and thinking what a fantastic player he was. And I know Germany went on to win the World Cup in 74. He lost his place to Overath. He was a good player. But any time I saw Netzer, I just thought he was fabulous.
Is that not the game where Alf Ramsey put out guys like Peter Storey and Norman Hunter and tried to intimidate the Germans? And rather than play them a proper game of football, he tried to sort of get it into a battle. And the Germans they ripped him apart. What I remember of that game is the Germans, but the first time I remember Germany playing in that green strip.
Yeah, I remember the fact that they hardly gave England a kick.
Played them off the park.
They kept the ball, and Netzer was he was just in the hub of it all. It all revolved round about him. And then, as I say, didn't play in the World Cup final. But I think years later, Rangers played Borussia Mönchengladbach at Ibrox. And I think Borussia thrashed him. And he was again the key player. He was a unique footballer, Gunter Netzer. Really brilliant player.
So, Robert, you get any clear memories of the league campaign and through to clinching the title against away to East Fife and then going on and only we lost and drew the last two games of the season?
Yeah, I remember wanting to go to Bayview in Methil for the game that Saturday. It was a brilliant sunny day, but the ground was so small. It was quite hard to get in, given that there was obviously going to be East Fife fans there as well. And for some reason, I think for that reason, I wasn't allowed to go because it was probably going to be overcrowded and it only held about 10,000. I remember the day at Falkirk when Danny McGrain fractured his skull.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, he didn't play again for quite a while. And that was, you know, the first of a number of setbacks that Danny had in his career, because he was doing well. He'd played in a couple of the big European matches, so he really had established himself at right back, and it, you know, Jim Craig came in for the rest of the season. I mean, I can't remember the story about the boycott at Tynecastle, because if you look at the stats for that last game of the season, when Hearts beat us 4-1, the crowd was about 13,500. But we'd played them 2 months earlier in a Scottish Cup replay, after the first game had been drawn at Parkhead, and there was over 40,000 at Tynecastle. And I think it had been a bit of a battle on and off the field. And for some reason, the Celtic Supporters Association decided not to go for the final league match. And
the more things change, the more things stay the same. It was ticket prices. It was a boycott because of excessive ticket prices at Tynecastle.
Or was it just as simple as that? I thought it had been more about fan behaviour, or, you know, how the fans were treated at the first time Tynecastle game in the Scottish Cup.
The Celtic team, when we clinched the title against East Fife, so the Celtic team for the winning the seventh title in a row was Williams, Craig, Quinn, Murdoch, McNeil, Connolly, Hood, Dalglish, Deans, Callaghan, McCarry, with Pat McCluskey coming on as a sub for McCarry. And Deans got 2:39 and 77 minutes, and Harry Hood scored the third. And as you quite rightly say, Robert, Bayview, not the biggest ground in the world. There was a capacity 12,000 at the game. And that was the record-breaking thing. And that, you know, that was the thing that Celtic got to watch out for this time, going for 9 and 10 in a row. Jock's team, you know, Celtic clinching a record-breaking seventh league title in a row, which Jock Sean says won't happen again in his lifetime. Which sadly he was right.
Well, sadly he was right.
Yeah.
It's interesting when you look at the league, though, the teams that were in it, like Airdrie and Inverlyn and Albion Rovers, Ayr United, Partick Thistle, East Fife, they're all away down in the doldrums of Scottish football nowadays. First division teams.
If I go through, this was how the league finished that season. Celtic finished with 60 points after 34 games. Remember, it was 2 points for a win, 96 goals scored, 28 against. Aberdeen finished on 50 points. Rangers finished on 44 points. As I said earlier, they lost 11 games in a 34 game season. So Celtic, Aberdeen, Rangers, Hibs were in the same points as Rangers. They lost fewer games but drew more. So it was Celtic, Aberdeen, Rangers, Hibs, Dundee, Hearts, Partick Thistle, St Johnstone, Dundee United, Motherwell, Kilmarnock, Ayr United, Morton, Falkirk, Airdrie, East Fife, Clyde and Dunfermline. Clyde and Dunfermline getting relegated. Winners of the first division that season, the winners were Dumbarton. It was Dumbarton and Arbroath that came up. Hamilton Academicals finished bottom of the whole Scottish League structure that season. So
the one game that sticks in my mind in the running was the Aberdeen game. It must have been maybe late March, where it was the last chance for Aberdeen, who were second, to make it a two-horse race. And Celtic went up there and got a comfortable draw. And I just remember from that moment onwards, it was a matter of time, it was a formality. That Celtic, it was just a case of when we would win it. Because that was Aberdeen's last throw of the dice. And if they'd won it, Pittodrie, it might have brought them back into the great scheme of things. But the Celtic, the draw was enough to see them off.
So we clinched the second league, seventh league title in a row. Scottish Cup that season, again, to continue my theme of what the hell are we moaning about with Scottish Cup draws? So we are drawn every single game in Glasgow. We play every single game in Glasgow bar a replay against Hearts. We beat Albion Rovers 5-0. We beat Dundee 4-0. We are drawn at home to Hearts and draw one each before going to Tynecastle and winning a replay. We then, in the semi-final, beat Kilmarnock 3-1. And then I think most of us will have at least seen the footage of the 6-1 victory over Hibs in the Scottish Cup final. So who wants to take me with their memories of that Scottish Cup run?
I can start, if you like. I think it was at all the games. Mm-hmm. And but just sort of kind of fast-forwarding to, you know, pretty comfortable wins, obviously, apart from two very tough ties against Hearts in the quarter-final. I remember Dixie getting a couple against Kelly in the semi. The semis were always played on Wednesday nights. Or not always, but often played on Wednesday nights, and that was one of them, and there was a good crowd there that day. But Hibs had beaten Rangers in the semi. The other semi-final after a replay, massive crowd, I think 75,000 at Hampden, and Hibs were playing some good football, had a good team. They had Eddie Turnbull, who had caused us a lot of problems in his years with Aberdeen. So I don't think, you know, nobody could have predicted such an emphatic victory. We scored in the first couple of minutes. Big Billy, not with his head, but, you know, with quite an assured side foot finish. I was at the Rangers end that day, and yeah, it was the great view of that goal. Brilliant start, but then they got back into it. Alan Gordon, who was a very good striker in Scottish football, he equalised, and then, you know, Dixie got his first goal with a header from a free kick, and you know, it was a good first half. It was 2-1. It was a close game. I remember there was crowd trouble, and there was cans and bottles flying up the Rangers end, and I actually got hit by a whiskey tumbler.
Oh,
and just didn't get cut, you know, just more of a scratch. And, you know, it was 2-1 or 3-1 at the time, and Celtic are winning. And I think, and I was with my dad's friend, and he says, you know, why the hell is people throwing glasses and bottles, you know, when we're winning the cup final? And fans spilled onto the pitch behind the goal, the goal that Celtic were then defending in the second half. And then a guy, a couple of rows in front of me, he got hit by a whiskey bottle. I remember my dad's friend saying, oh, we're in the range of, you know, somebody up the back is just launching them. And we moved away from kind of being behind the goal. We moved around, still in the Rangers end, but more round towards the corner at the south stand. And we saw the other goals from that position. You know, Dixie scored these memorable solo goal and his somersaults and his... And it was a wonderful moment for Dixie because, well, we haven't talked about the European Cup, but if you look at photographs or footage, the joy on the other players' faces when Dixie scores, when Dixie turns away after scoring that solo goal, you can see in one picture there's Jinky, there's Kenny Dalglish, there's somebody else, and the look on their faces is, you know, it's just priceless. And, you know, he went on to get his hat-trick, and it turned out to be Jim Craig's last game for Celtic. and very appropriately, Jim Craig set up the two late goals for Lou McCarrie in the last 5 or 6 minutes to give us the 6-1 win. It was the biggest winning margin or the biggest score in a Scottish Cup final since 1888. When I looked it up, Renton beat Cambuslang 6-1 in a Scottish Cup final in front of 10,000 people. There was 106,000 people at this Celtic Hibs game. And, you know, apart from the crowd trouble, which I think was inexplicable, really. And I think the crowd trouble was not caused by crushes, but really by people throwing things, as I've mentioned. So, fantastic victory. Hibs had played pretty well for an hour, but, you know, the game just ran away from them at the end. Bertie Auld was on the bench for Hibs that day. And, you know, it wasn't the last time we were to see Hibs in a cup final at Hampden over the next 2 or 3 years. So, fantastic day and a great double for the club. Another great league and cup double.
I'm going to ask you about the game in a minute, Lackey, but just Robert, you talking there about the trouble, you posted a tweet this week actually saying, which sort of mentioned this principle that the 70s was, this was the start of trouble at games for no reason other than people were looking for trouble at games, and the principle that people were chucking stuff in the back of the terrace and all they did was hit their own fans at the front of the terrace. Just bonkers, you know. And again, getting back to one of my bugbears, even though I'm a teetotaler, the fact they don't sell alcohol at football, all based on basically what happened in the 10 years at football games that culminated in the 80 Cup final riot. But the reality is they never sold drink at the football. It was people bringing drink in, always was. It was people bringing bottles in and chucking them in.
Harry, you must remember yourself when you were younger, because right up to the late 70s, it wasn't unusual to see young boys wear hard hats to football games, and what they would do is they would put stickers on them and they would paint them green and white and put slogans on them. And the reason for wearing the hard hats apparently was down to the fact that it wasn't a style accessory, but it was practical, because if you were in a certain part of the stadium, you stood a good chance of bottles or cans getting thrown, and this protected your head.
So Lackey, were you at this cup, were you any of the cup games and in the, at this cup final?
I think it was at the semi-final and the final. I'm fairly sure of that. Again, I think you've seen the goals so often from a different angle. You're trying to remember what was it like on the day. But I was there. I know that. As you said, there was. I wasn't aware of the trouble at the time. I only read about it later on because I was up at Celtic and I used to always go to the Celtic end. The only time I was ever in the Rangers end or any Celtic game was the Thistle game. And the defeat by Dunfermline in 1960. So I don't have a good record of being in the Rangers then. But I mean, it was just a brilliant performance. And Dixie Deans was just a terrific centre forward. I remember when he signed, someone questioned Steena about his signing. And he actually said, no one's ever paid him enough to make him behave. But he'll have to behave now. And he did. I mean, I think he was only ordered off once after that. And that was in the reserve game. But he was as sharp as a tack round about the penalty area. And he was a good player. He could link the game up nicely. So there are some players that you keep telling me that Lee Griffiths can't link the game up, Harry, but I believe he does. And Dixie was the same. Although he was the spearhead and the main goal scorer, you could play the ball up to him and the play would continue. And then he'd go away and finish things off.
I remember, he's absolutely brilliant in the air.
He was fantastic in the air. He was great in the air. Yeah. He was the closest thing we'd had to Joe McBride in terms of the way he played. I think Joe was a wee bit more mobile, but Dixie could get about as well. He was a good, good player.
I remember selling Dixie Deans at a pub in Bayleson, and I remember selling it. And this would be about 20 years ago. And I always thought it was really odd. You go in the pub and there was one wall was pictures of him playing for Motherwell. Two other walls was pictures of him playing for Celtic. And as you went in the pub, there was a huge big sign saying, no club colours. I always thought, who's going to go to Dixie Dean's pub standing amongst all these pictures of, you know, which Ranger, you know, Rangers fans going to go standing amongst all those pictures and then wear a Rangers scarf or be irritated someone's wearing a Celtic scarf. Anyway, that was...
I read in the Celtic Wiki that he had been a St Mirren fan. He was never a Rangers fan. But in Campbell's book, Campbell and Potter's book, they indicated that he was a Rangers supporter. He maintains he wasn't. He was a St Mirren
fan. I also knew someone who only ever called him John, and he said he didn't like being called Dixie.
I think George Steen called him John. Sure he did.
Mm-hmm.
He was, I mean, we only paid £20,000 for him. I mean, it may have been one of the best pieces of business. When we've talked about signing Joe McBride, signing Willie Wallace, you know, and along with Deans and Hood, these were the four, you know, master signings. They, you know, they scored hundreds of goals for Celtic. And, you know, Deans's record by the time he left was, you know, was a... on the same level as Willie Wallace. So Wallace leaves, Deans arrives 6 weeks later, and, you know, it really was business as usual, although he was a different type of player from Willie Wallace.
You think I was reading that on the day that Wallace made his debut for Celtic, Dixie was getting ordered off at Motherwell. I read that last night.
Was it not the same game?
No, they weren't playing. He was playing for Motherwell. Dixie was a young player signing for Motherwell, and Willie Wallace was playing, making his debut for Celtic.
Right.
But on that day, Dixie got ordered off.
So the teams in that Scottish Cup final were Williams, Craig, Brogan, Murdoch, McNeil, Connolly, Johnson, Deans, McCarry, Dalglish and Callaghan, with Bobby Lennox on the bench. Hibs team, decent team. Herriot, Brownlee, Shadler, Stanton, Black, Blackley, Edwards, Hazel, Gordon, O'Rourke and Duncan, with Bertie Auld coming on for Duncan. It's probably, I mean, I wasn't there, but it's maybe the same principle of the Thistle game and games that we've all seen. Once Celtic get to 3-4 goals, you know, the game's over for Hibs. And
was Cropley not playing for Hibs? Was Alec Cropley not playing for Hibs that day?
He's one of their top players, but I think he must have been injured
because he wasn't in the team.
He didn't get transferred for about another year and a half later before he went to Arsenal, I think. Arsenal or Aston Villa, I can't remember.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, Alex Edwards was a really good player. I mean, at times, but a brilliant player. And I thought Alan Gordon was a thoroughbred. He was just a good player to watch.
So... that's the league and the cup double tied up. The league tied up early, the cup with a thumping 6-1 victory. But you cannot talk about any of that without talking about the European campaign. And again, another season of it nearly was, and what could have been. We went to Copenhagen and it was 2-1 in Copenhagen, 3-0 at Celtic Park. Then Salima Wanderers, I mean, to some extent it shows you the difference in the modern competition with seeding, as you pointed out before, Saint, in podcast. Salima Wanderers of Malta in the second round, which by beating them we get through to European football past Christmas. Salima Wanderers 5-0 at Celtic Park and 2-1 away. Then Utrecht Doza with the famous Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor party for Celtic fans. In Hungary, we beat Utrecht Doza 2-1 there and draw 1-1 at Celtic Park, so it's 3-2, and then Inter Milan, and it's a replay of the 1967 European Cup final. We go to Milan and we draw 0-0 in Milan, so we're coming back to Celtic Park, and the expectation is, if we've gone to Milan and drawn 0-0 with the likes of Dalglish and Macari scoring goals, then, you know, the newspaper, the Evening Times story after Celtic have gone there, Jock Steen says, after drawing 0-0 in Milan, "My players did a wonderful job. We can only knock ourselves out now." And Malcolm Munro of the Times, the headline is, "Celts could have won this round." You couldn't be in Milan this last night and remain unattached. You are with Celtic and you are for Celtic. And his whole report is the fact that Celtic are virtually through. So, Robert, do you want to take us through the European Cup campaign, where it looks like we're going through?
Yep. I was at all four home games and remember them all for different reasons. The night against Copenhagen was very, very tense. We had played, we'd lost the first leg 2-1, where all the goals came early in the match. Jock Steen described it as our worst performance in European competition since he had taken over. And the second leg, I think we thought we would blow them away. And we, you know, we had plenty of chances, but at halftime it was 1-0 and Willie Wallace had scored. And we were missing chances. And in fact, they had hit the bar in the first half as well. And that would have upset things a little bit. And Steen brought on Yogi in the second half. And one of the first things that Yogi did was miss a penalty. And that did nothing to calm anybody's nerves. And the game only really got decided in the last 10 minutes. Tommy Callaghan scored with a bullet header from the edge of the box. It was an absolute, one of the finest headers I think I've seen. Power and placed right in the roof of the net. Real beauty. And Wallace wrapped it up right at the end in what turned out to be his last goal for the club. So I think it'd been a bit of a scare. And the Maltese was obviously pretty easy victory, which saw Tommy Gemmell's last goal for Celtic. He blasted one in from distance. Classic Tommy Gemmell strike. But, you know, Tommy was on the way out by then. And his very last game was for the club was the game in Malta. So quite a lot of excitement. The games against Ujpest Doza, the Hungarians were out of season. This was an early March game, and so that favoured us that their league had not yet started, because I think they followed more the Soviet timing. And we went over there, and if Jock Steen considered Copenhagen to be our worst performance in Europe, he said afterwards that the performance in Budapest was our best performance since Lisbon in Europe. And it was only the second time that McGrain, Hay, Connolly, Dalglish and McCarry started a game together for Celtic. And in fact, it only ever happened 10 or 11 times. And we played really well in a dreadful pitch. I think there was thunder and lightning. The game was live on STV. Maybe a 4:30 afternoon kickoff, and the goals. The big Hungarian centre back Horvath scored two spectacular goals in the game. One for each team, a header into his own net, and then a 30-yarder past Evan Williams, who had a terrific game that night. And then at the end, or I think 5 minutes to go, if I'm remembering correctly, Lou McCarry put away a great poacher's finish. And, you know, for me, McCarry was becoming our Gerd Müller. He was just so sharp in the box. We've just talked about how Dixie could score goals with a head, goals from different positions. McCarry was just razor sharp that season. I thought he was brilliant and strong little player as well. So we went back, as you say, you know, there was about 100 more fans, ended up in a Budapest hotel with Hollywood's golden couple, Liz Taylor and Richard Burton. Burton, of course, was Welsh, but he had Scottish relatives. And they put on a party after the game. I think they thought the players and the official party were going to attend as well, but they flew straight back to Glasgow after the match. So there was about 100-odd fans turned up, brilliantly covered in Jerry McNee's book that was written, I think, in the 70s or early 80s. But apparently Richard Burton did say, nobody's leaving until we've spent the £5,000 on the chip. And, you know, I'm trying to think, Budapest prices in 1972, 5,000 quid would have been a bit of a challenge, you know, even for a bunch of very thirsty Glaswegians. So good on them. And I think the story goes that Steen got a call a couple of days later from Richard Burton's brother in Wales to thank him and, you know, for the great result, and that Richard Burton was going to be following Celtic for the rest of the tournament. The home game against the Hungarians, 75,000 at Parkhead, 80,000 at Ibrox the same night when they were playing Torino in the quarterfinal of the Cup Winners' Cup. And the Hungarians went a goal up very early on in the game, which made everybody extremely nervous. I remember the Hungarians' all-purple strip, which was pretty unusual. And, you know, again, McCarry got us out of jail in the second half. A big long ball up the park by George Connolly, and he brought it down in his chest and lobbed the goalie. Tremendous goal. Even at one each, you know, if the Hungarians had scored, it would have gone into extra time. But we held out, and that was us in the semis. And in the semi-final, as you say, Harry, we were drawn against old foes Inter Milan. And the other semi-final was also old foes Ajax against Benfica. And I think the big motivation for Ajax was that the final was going to be in Rotterdam that year. And so it was a great result for us against the Hungarians. Rangers went through the same night against Torino. And Torino were actually top of Serie A on the day of that game. So tremendous result for them. 155,000 people at two games in Glasgow on the same night.
That to me is the most remarkable thing. Excuse me. That for the return leg against Inter Milan, us and Rangers are both playing. They're playing Bayern Munich, and we're playing. I mean, it's just incredible. That, as you say, Robert, there's no way the police today would allow two games. No. It's 80,000 at Ibrox and 75,000 at Celtic Park to be taking place on the same night in the same city.
Yeah. Well, I'm prepared to bet there was hardly any arrests that night at either game or in the town afterwards. Otherwise, I think there might have been an issue with the semi-finals where the whole routine was repeated. But quite soon after that, they did change the rules so that you didn't have to have two big games on in the same night. And under the new rules, Rangers would have had to switch their ties. So the European Cup took precedence in these types of decisions. So the match at the San Siro, we played very well, and I think pretty comfortable 0-0 draw. Pat McCluskey had to come on, very inexperienced 19-year-old defender, when Jim Brogan got injured. But he played well enough, and I think he played in the return game at Parkhead. And I was in the Rangers end at Parkhead on the second leg, and we started that game really well. As I recall, the best chances in the game fell to Jim Craig in the first 10, 15 minutes, and he came really close to scoring. And after that, Inter just, I think they just wore us down with their negativity and their ability to stop the play, concede a lot of free kicks. Passing back to the goalkeeper was still allowed at that time. And they kind of killed the game, and I don't remember us having many chances. I don't even remember it being that noisy or that exciting in the second half. I think there was just so much tension in the stadium that one mistake, like what had happened against AC Milan a couple of years earlier, one mistake and we're out if they get the away goal. But Inter were playing with 10, 11 men behind the ball, and they were just waiting for us to make a slip up, or they were playing for penalties. And I don't remember anything exceptional happening in extra time either. But Dixie came on as substitute for Kenny Dalglish during the game. And then when it went to the penalty shootout, Deans, who'd apparently just didn't miss in all the training and the penalty-taking practices that had taken place in the previous days, Inter were first to play to take the penalties. Mazzola scored, and then Dixie put his over the bar. And I think Evan Williams says that Jock Steen told him where every single Inter penalty was going to go. And I think Jock was right. But the only one Evan Williams nearly saved was the second one, where Facchetti's shot, Williams tipped it onto the bar and it came down on the line. And, you know, they didn't miss. So they had won the penalty shootout at 5-3, although Bobby Murdoch was then asked to, I think, come back onto the pitch. The players had already left the pitch, and Murdoch came on to take the fifth Celtic penalty. So it was officially a 5-4. And again, under today's rules, that wouldn't have been necessary for Murdoch to take a penalty. So, you know, savage disappointment for the club. I think Steen's reflections afterwards were that with this new young team, he hadn't actually expected us to get as far as the semi-finals. He thought that would have been beyond us. Would we have beaten Ajax in the final? I think we'd have given them a better game than Inter Milan, even though the match was in Holland. And I think arguably we were a better team in 72 than the team that Ajax had beaten in 71. You know, we just had a younger team, albeit we'd lost Danny McGrain. I think Davy Hay was also injured at that stage of the season. So I think it would have been a tough final for us in Rotterdam if we had gotten through. But who knows? Winnable.
Robert, I always remember the Daily Record the next day always had a wee cartoon. It was a guy called Rod, who was a cartoonist. And his cartoons never failed to amuse. He was a genius. And the cartoon following Dixie's penalty miss was two guys in the moon had found a ball, and they were radioing back to Earth saying, "Tell Dixie we found the ball." I often wonder in later years whether Jock Steen regretted not having Tommy Gemmell and Willie Wallace that night against the Italians, because there's no doubt that Macari and Dalglish and maybe even Hay and Connolly had matured into wonderful players, but they didn't quite have at that time that level of experience against such hardened, steeled opposition which Inter Milan had, because Inter at that time still had Mazzola and Facchetti and Burdic and Boninsenga, these guys who'd played in the 1970 World Cup final for Italy against Brazil. These were hardened professionals who'd been round the block. And I often wonder that if Willie Wallace's experience in the attack or Tommy Gemmell's long-range shooting would have terrified the Italians. And I wonder in his later years if Jock regretted not having the two of them available, and that maybe he discarded them just 12 months too soon.
Yeah, but then the counter to that would be he had a young, exciting team, as we just talked about. Dalglish, Deans, Macari were banging in the goals at a rate that the older players were not doing. So who knows, because you might never have got to play Inter Milan if you'd had an older, aging team there. Well, as we saw last season, the team was really starting to fade at the end of last season.
The fact that Inter Milan were even in the semi-finals was a matter of some contention, because in the second round of the European Cup that year, they'd been beaten 7-1 by Borussia Mönchengladbach.
Yep.
And Boninsenga, that you just mentioned, saying he'd been hit by a Coca-Cola can when the score was 2-1. And not sure if it was a full or an empty can, but in any event, he kind of fell over and, you know, was injured. And after the match was finished, UEFA ruled that the match would have to be replayed. And it was replayed, but they played the game at the San Siro first and Inter won 4-2 and then Haven lost 7-1 in Mönchengladbach. They got a 0-0. So they went through and then they struggled through against Standard Liège on away goals in the quarterfinals. So, as you say, the Jurgeniches, the Mazzolas, the Fachettis, Jair, they still had a whole raft of players who had played in their 64 and 65 European Cup winning teams as well as lost to us in Lisbon. So they were an ageing team and almost cannon fodder for, you know, the Ajax team that they played in the final. But their tactics in the final were exactly the way they played at Parkhead. They just defended deep and tried to kill the game. And, you know, Cruyff got two goals in the second half to win the competition for them again.
I think that not playing Dixie Deans from the start was a mistake.
Good point.
Because as we talked about, he was scoring goals for fun. And you just, why not play him?
Well, it was his first ever appearance in European football when he came on for Dalglish that night. And but as we said, or you said, Harry, you know, 27 goals in 27 games. Why wouldn't you play him?
Yeah.
But he went with guys with a... Because he was playing so many young players, you know, the Dalglishes, the, you know, didn't have a lot of European experience, then he maybe went with experience where he could.
I do have to say as well that the Ajax were approaching their peak at that point. That was them 2 years into their 3 year run as being European champions. Now, I often again think that when you look at how close we were to getting to the final in 72 and 74, 72 obviously against Ajax, 74 against Bayern Munich, I don't think we would have beaten Ajax in Rotterdam. That would have been to play a team at Ajax stature at that point in their own country, but almost at home advantage would have been very difficult. But I do think that in 74 we would have had a better chance against Bayern Munich, because Bayern also won it three times in succession, but each time they won it there was a wee bit of good fortune with Bayern Munich. I don't think they were a class team, but they weren't quite the level that Ajax were at. So my opinion would be that I think Ajax would have won in 72, but I do think I would love to have seen us against Bayern in 74.
You would never know.
Neither Hay nor McGrain would have been available for the final. They didn't play in either of the semi-final games because of injury, and they wouldn't have. I don't think they would have played in the final, which was late May when the game took place. But the Ajax breakthrough in the final came from just across from the wing, which the goalie comes out, and I had a look at the footage this week, and the goalkeeper comes off his line and collides with a centre-back, and they just run into each other, and Cruyff's just standing there on his own, and of course, Cruyff being Cruyff, he kills the ball stone dead first time and taps it into an empty net. But, you know, Ajax had some difficulty getting near enough to the goals in the first half, at least.
I think Celtic would have posed a much bigger threat to Ajax than Inter Milan did. You know,
definitely.
In neither of those games did Inter Milan ever look like winning. And they just smothered the game at Celtic Park. But even in Italy, they didn't look as if they were going to beat the Celtic.
And therefore, maybe we should have played a more attacking lineup.
If Celtic had reached the final, I'm not absolutely sure that they would have been horsed, because I think they were a better team that year than they were the year that we lost to Ajax. I was going to go to the semi-final. It was during the Easter holidays, and Tokos Travel had advertised a trip out to the semi-final in Milan, and at the last minute, for some reason, it was cancelled.
Well, talking about travel, the one thing I remember vividly is that there was boys in my school that their dads had promised them a trip to the final. And obviously when we'd drawn the first game away 8-0-0 and were favourites going into the home leg, These boys were so excited at the prospect of going to Rotterdam to European Cup final. Some of their fathers had paid down payments, paid deposits, and they obviously get the deposits back. But it was such a crushing blow. And even as a young boy looking back and being in primary school at the time, that's probably my biggest disappointment as a Celtic fan, because I'll never forget that horrible feeling of when Dixie missed the penalty. That you know, it's bad enough to get beat in a semi-final at any stage, but to lose it in penalties was desperate, absolutely desperate.
First team to lose a European game on penalties.
Yeah.
Well, there was only really two big disappointments of the season. One was the Partick Thistle Cup final, but the Inter Milan one was much worse than that. Obviously, there was much more at stake. It's always interesting, I think, as to how five players get selected to take a penalty kick. And, you know, Dixie had never taken a penalty for Celtic, but he'd done well in training, which we know is absolutely nothing like taking one in under pressure. Jimmy Johnson took a penalty. Jim Craig took one of the five penalties. He'd never taken a penalty for Celtic. I think Pat McCluskey. I don't know if it was Pat McCluskey or George Connolly.
Pat McCluskey, yeah.
Pat McCluskey took one.
I've heard a few people talking about it, and I think it's just simply the people who, I mean, I remember watching the documentary about when England lost in the 1990 World Cup, the Bobby Robson thing, and it was different players had been lined up in training to take the penalties. But on the day, I can't remember who, I think it was Stuart Pearce or Chris Waddle, one of the two of them hadn't been taking them in training, but wanted to take them on the day. And Bobby Robson's attitude was, it's the people who, when they're in that atmosphere, believe that they can take a penalty, are the ones that you choose to take the penalties.
Okay, but how many misses did England have?
Well, that's just it. I mean, England missed it, but
shouldn't have been anywhere near a penalty.
But I think that's the thing, that I think it comes down as much to who's got the emotion and steel to be able to do it when you're in the atmosphere of doing it. Do you have any strong memories of it, Lackey?
I have this theory of the penalty kicks that you don't let left footers take them, and also, so many great strikers down the years in World Cup finals and things like that, great strikers have missed penalties.
Right. Roberto Baggio.
They've got time to think about it.
We ended up going to Seville.
The guys who live on their reactions.
We went to Seville because Henrik Larsson missed a penalty.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you're right, Lackey. I think for goal scorers, in most cases, it's an instinctive reaction to a ball being played into you at speed. You know, there's other strikers who are great at, you know, with the ball at their feet, they run, they chip the goalie, they dink the goalie. But, for example, that night at Parkhead, Macari, you know, who'd had a great season, doesn't take a penalty. I think Bobby Lennox played that night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, second top goal scorer in Celtic's history, doesn't take a penalty. So it's an interesting discussion.
When it gets as tense as that did that night, it's a lottery.
Yeah,
it is a lottery. Jockstein called it a circus act.
I mean, the goalkeeper can be very unlucky, and he can also be very lucky. And many times you've seen goalkeepers almost making a great save and it hits the post and goes in. You know, and other times they're diving the wrong way and it hits their foot.
Mm-hmm. And it was us that got the rules changed. Because after that toss of the coin victory in Lisbon in 69, we had made representations to UEFA that the toss of the coin was a rubbish way to decide a football match. Yeah. And, you know, we ended up with penalty kicks. After this defeat in penalty kicks, I think we tried to change the rules again and made representations to say that it shouldn't apply in the, you know, the quarterfinals or the semi-finals, or that I think Celtic suggested number of corners, you know, should be a factor in consideration. And it was interesting about the toss of the coin, because We have to give credit to Rangers, who beat Bayern Munich that night and got to the final in Barcelona. But in an earlier round, you know, they had their own drama in Lisbon, much the same as we'd had drama in Lisbon with the Benfica game in 69. And incredibly, it was the same Dutch referee. So when Rangers beat Sporting Lisbon 3-2 in the first game at Ibrox, and then they went to Portugal and Sporting Lisbon won 3-2, the match went into extra time and Sporting Lisbon won 4-3. And then Van Ravens, the Dutch referee, ordered a penalty shootout. And I think Rangers missed all their penalties. And so Sporting Lisbon were running around celebrating. And Willie Waddle got hold of the UEFA observer and pointed out to him the rules about the away goal counting double. And Rangers clearly had gone through on away goals. And, you know, obviously the decision about who won the match was reversed. And, you know, Rangers were on their way to Barcelona, which, you know, as a whole, you could probably have an entire podcast about that match and the aftermath on its own. I don't really want to go into it. But that was a curious, very curious moment in Rangers. What had been a great campaign for Rangers, because they'd beaten teams from France, Portugal, Italy and Germany to get to the final and then beat Russians. So it was quite an achievement. And as you said right at the beginning, Harry, you know, their domestic form had been pretty awful.
Robert, I always think it would have been better if Rangers would have won in 67 rather than 72. And the reason why I say that is, what an achievement it would have been for the city of Glasgow to have two European trophy winners from the same city in the same season. I mean, that would have been absolutely outstanding and a great record that probably may never have been equaled.
Yeah. Well, the irony was that in the 1972 semi-finals, those fixtures from 1967 were repeated, but the outcomes were different in both cases.
Well, so the way that we've just described the kick in the guts for Celtic of going out on penalties makes it all the more remarkable that we went on to secure the double that season and so emphatically beat Hibs in the final. So that's double winning season, record-breaking seventh title in a row. Pretty much round things up. The only thing I'm going to ask you guys of wider things that were going on in the 71-72 season, see if you can remember much about it. Some of the sort of key things where the troubles in Northern Ireland were starting to become a real issue with the numbers of deaths. There was the Clarkston gas explosion that killed 20 people. That was just before my parents were moving up to Glasgow from Stranraer. That was all at the end of the 71-72 season, the end of 1971, and into 1972, the miners' strike started in January 72. Ted Heath called a state of emergency in February 1972, and we will, at the beginning of the next season's podcast, will be when the Munich Munich Olympics was on, and we had athletes killed at that. So it was starting to be, you know, getting back to what we talked about before. Vietnam was coming to its zenith, really starting to see body bags coming home from America. It was starting to be a violent time in the world. Either of you guys have any strong memories of life outside football back then, Lackey?
Well, I remember being away in the Vietnam War because I used to subscribe to Time magazine and Newsweek, so I kept up with sort of what was going on there in the American situation. The troubles, as you say, were beginning to explode in Northern Ireland, but I wasn't fully cognizant of what was going on. I can't remember that the Clarkson thing. I think the effects of the miners' strike were felt more, I think, a couple of years later.
Yeah.
In the short time
3 day week.
Yes, that was more of an impact then.
Robert, one thing I can remember about this period as a very young boy being at school, I'm sure that was one of the years, it may have been, I don't know if it was 1 year or 2 years, whereby the clocks didn't go back in October, and it meant that mornings were very, very dark. And as I said, I don't know if it was that this season or the season before that, or maybe even both, but there was a period in the early 70s where we didn't mess about with the clocks, and it meant that the mornings, particularly for kids going to school, were very, very dark.
Robert, do you have any specific strong memories?
Well, I think Bloody Sunday was around this time, was it not? Mm-hmm. I can't remember. Was it 71 or 72?
January 72.
January 72. And I think that was, when I kind of woke up to the fact that, things were getting pretty bad over there. I had family in the Republic of Ireland, I remember that. Same as Lackey, I remember the miners' strike in 1973 vividly because of just the more widespread impact.
Of course, the big thing in Glasgow would have been the sit-in in 71-72, where the guys and the shipbuilders took control of the yards.
Yeah, we talked about that a lot because that was at the end of the previous season.
Yeah.
And then the Clarkson disaster, I remember, because, you know, the reaction in the city was, you know, what have we done to deserve this so soon after the Ibrox disaster to have another, major event, so much in the city. But I think this had been a great season for Celtic.
Yeah. Looking back at it later on, I don't think any of us were fully aware of it at the time, but it was in the summer of 1972 that the Watergate scandal broke.
Yeah. Well,
the burglary took place.
And that the election was in 72.
Yeah. It was in June 1972.
Yeah, that was the event.
Yes, what I'm saying.
It was quite a bit aware of the
impact that would have.
And in films, two absolutely classic films were out in 1972.
Godfather, surely.
Yeah, well, the classic bank holiday film of the last 40 years, The Poseidon Adventure, was out. And yeah, Godfather was also out. Deliverance was also out that year as well.
Before we go, there was a guy the other day, a follower on Twitter, was saying that their first nine in a row had no value because they weren't competing at the time. And I couldn't resist, had to point out to him that not only had they beat us in the Scottish Cup final and the League Cup final in those years, they had also won the European Cup Winners' Cup.
Well, in this season in particular.
Final. So they can hardly say they weren't the competitive.
Well, that's them coming up with excuses whenever they want. But with that, I will say, guys, speak to you next week when we go for number 8. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that was season 7. I think I said in this podcast before, I always remember being at Hampden, just listening to the pipes there, and they used to have the pipe bands on at half time. Guy in a broad Glasgow accent shouting over the back of me, "Get these Scottish bees off." Anyway, that was season 7, 71-72. Next season, season 8, is just a single trophy season, but we see the real emergence of Danny McGrain, Kenny O'Gleish, as George Connolly becoming stalwarts in the side. It's a season where the goalkeeping duties are shared amongst three keepers, and we'll save it all for next week. Anyway, enough of me. You can hear the pipe band in the background. Stay safe. Look after yourselves. By the time you're listening to this, 10 o'clock, I'm recording this at 11:30 at night, and tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock in the morning, stuff's happening in Scottish football. Anyway, stay safe, look after yourselves. This is me, Harry Brady. That was Robert Lackey Moore, St Anthony, saying goodnight and God bless. Good night.